Hello, and welcome to episode number 120 of The Big Web Show. Everything web that matters. I'm your host, Jeffrey Zeldman, and with me today are the authors of Designing the Editorial Experience, a Primer for Print, Web, and Mobile, Sue Applebaum and Juliet Cesar.
Hello.
Hello. Sue and Juliet, this is an epic book with many levels to it. Overview, case studies, and a multiple audience. It's not just for people who make websites by a long shot.
Yeah.
How did you two meet and start and decide to do this book? What made you decide to do this book?
Okay. Well, we met because we worked together on a publication. I guess it was 2005. We worked together. It was called Res Magazine, R-E-S.
R-E-S.
And it was a bimonthly print magazine that came bundled with a DVD. And we had a pretty rudimentary.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, this is cutting edge, though.
Yeah.
So the subject matter of the magazine was sort of digital creatives, sort of computers, Macs, digital tools being on the desktop, enabling this whole creative field.
And you're making me so nostalgic.
Yeah. Well,
that whole thing. It's like watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer. It's a definite time. Definite time slice. So it was about digital creatives and it had a DVD inside.
Yes.
But it's also a print magazine.
It was a print magazine, came out every 2 months. And
you don't have that. Every 2 months is not in your book. You got quarterly, you got monthly, you got weekly, you got every minute. You don't have every 2 months, did you?
Yeah, there are fewer bi-monthly publications right now. And it's hard to remember what we had in there, but when we were looking, we did have bi-monthly as one of the segments, and it seems like there are fewer these days, that more people are going towards maybe a quarterly schedule or twice a year or, you know, some odd combination of 8 issues a year.
And so Sue is one of the co-editors of the magazine. I was the art director until it closed. And
were you co-founders? Were you employees?
No.
We were employees. It was a long time ago.
You were young.
I started there in 2000. The magazine had already been in existence for, I think, about 4 years. So
was it like originally called like video something?
It's called like digital filmmaker.
It was Res, the magazine for digital filmmaking, and then they changed it to Res, art, music, film, and culture, because they wanted to move away from the techie aspect of it and not have tech be as much the focus and more just independent creativity.
I remember writing for Video 80. it wasn't 1980, but the fact that it was the 80s was still a thing to be proud of, I guess. And then by the time the issue came out, it was called Send because it was about transmission. And I think our industry, too, is sort of everything is in a – people were focused on end products and now we're focused on experience. That's a big theme in your book, actually, right? So start by talking about what format are we working in? That's so cool. And then it's like it now does that even matter? No, we're creating experiences – wherever the people are.
Well, I mean, one of the things that people have realized recently is that even if the organization they're working for is split up into different departments or like, oh, this is the mobile team, this is the web team, the people they're actually working for, meaning the readers, don't necessarily neatly divide into any of those categories. So you kind of need to know how something is being experienced across everything if you know who you're actually talking to.
You talk a lot in the book about the gap and sort of having the experience continue. People expect to maybe start reading at the newsstand, finish, you know, continue on their desktop browser, and then finish on their phone. And that's the norm now. And if things don't fit in these little categories at all.
And those are not special people. Those are everyone.
Right, everyone. Right. When you started writing for the magazine, it was still kind of an underground, you know,
Well, it's also interesting in that you know, the time that Rez was around, if you were a kid in Oklahoma who was like just discovering, you know, creativity at your fingertips or whatever, like that was really one of your only sources of information for that thing. You would wait for the magazine to show up mm-hmm. so you could actually read these profiles of people or watch these videos. And Google Video and YouTube, these things did not exist until 2006, 2007?
Yeah.
YouTube's 2006.
The magazine ceased publishing the same year that YouTube was beginning to take off. I mean, just the promise of streaming online, just it seemed imminent and it just wasn't yet. I mean, there's a longer story there behind the company and what their goals were, what they thought was going to be possible, all pre.com bust. And for a time, the magazine and the DVD and the festival that we did were it. And
festival
was, oh yeah. So Rez Fest was an actual annual live experience that brought together all sorts of great filmmaking talent and really kind of exposed the cutting edge of what was being made. And it was before you could just, you know, watch this on Vimeo or YouTube. You had to go to a theater to see it during these festivals. So
we waited until Ed Sullivan was ready to show it to us.
Yeah. Something like that, yeah.
No, everything is constantly available now.
Yeah.
Brian Eno wrote a piece about that with music, because when he was growing up and also when I was growing up, there were periods when certain kinds of music came out and you had to know where to go to get that music. I mean, there was pop, but everything else, you had to know about a cool record store and go to your friends and listen to their collection. And there was stuff that when I was growing up, that's not cool. Don't listen to that. Do listen to this. Like, you wouldn't be caught dead listening to, I don't know. You wouldn't be caught. You could listen to the Smiths, but you couldn't listen to Billy Joel. That's just a off the top of my head.
Well, that's just good taste.
Okay. That's still true. That one's still true. But now it's everything's simultaneously available, and kids are like, you know, they're like listening to 90s hip hop and electronica and Sinatra, and it's all just music. And that kind of ties with the theme of your book again, because things have gone away from that kid in Oklahoma waiting for a magazine to tell them what was going on, or that friend saying, listen to my record. Now everything's available. Really, the only obstacles are, like, did your parents put a filter on the, you know what I mean? By the way, is one of you from Oklahoma? Is that an actual autobiographical thing? Okay.
No.
Just an example.
I'm from Queens.
Okay.
I'm from Allentown, Pennsylvania, which is not quite Oklahoma, but felt like it at times growing up.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah. I love the musical Oklahoma, by the way.
But it's
props to Oklahoma.
But like what you're pointing out also has happened with the web. Like a lot of people initially, the problem that they were trying to solve for was like, how do we get everything all at once, like up on a homepage, up somewhere? Yep. Like, let's make everything at our fingertips. Like it was still kind of solving the problem of access to stuff rather than actually ordering that material in a way that somebody could actually have a good experience with it.
Rather than designing experiences or doing content strategy and saying, what should we have up? I can remember... Yeah. We used to get a project and they'd say, we have all this crap and we have to migrate it to this new system. It's going to be, you know, it's going to cost $1 million. And then there was this transition, and now it's like, and it's kind of mobile first. Luke Rebluski's idea is sort of the culmination of that. It's like, what should the experience be? What's the most important content? What do people want? What should the experience be? Not, we have this, you know, 8-year-old page about museum closings. So let's make sure we migrate that to the new system.
Well, also having everything available all at once, all the time, at the same level, I think finally, after so much time, like, people understand that that's not really a strategy.
Mm-hmm. Nicely said. Nicely said. It's right. That's right. That's right. We don't hear the word information architect very much anymore. It's a real discipline, and there are still people who are brilliant at it, and I think we all know some, but But now it's a different thing. It's really about design and content strategy.
And you have to be thinking about time. I mean, and that is the big difference between content strategy and information architecture. Is information architecture is laying things out in relationship to each other in space, whereas content strategy is trying to figure out how does time play into that. And I'm amazed that it's so new. Like, why? But at the same time, like, looking at the book and also talking to designers, print designers even, it actually isn't that new. You know, people have been thinking about this.
People have been thinking about issues forever. And when I started A List Apart, I was like, I always put an issue number on it, and I registered it as a periodical. Because I didn't, I got that it's like, you don't want to put everything out there at once. You want to have a surprise and say, come now and see this. Mm-hmm. Focus on this.
And you're building habits for people to expect something at a particular time, to know that something's going to be there. And, the web, for some reason, like, didn't really embrace that for a long time. Like, not everyone anyway.
The web people thought, and I was one of them, they don't get it. The old guard doesn't get it. So everything they do is useless. So issues, you know, a lot of people thought that's outdated. I publish now and now and now. Something happens, I do it now. I don't wait for the morning edition. What is that? So, but you were both in a print medium. You met in a print medium that was about digital media.
Yes.
And what was the thinking for designing the editorial experience? Were you noticing things in common across certain, say, really good sites or...
Well, we always remained friends, and we were always talking about new things that had come out, and we're also talking about our magazine, like what's going on with magazines these days, and just seeing that there was not that much attention being paid to also some really awesome things that people were making, or at least not all in one shot. Koi Vin wrote a piece. I don't know how long ago now, maybe 3 years ago.
It's 2011.
2011, talking about that, talking about how there were web designers who were really good at making the web, and then there were these print designers really good at making publications, and that there was this gigantic space in between.
Huge.
And now it's like slowly that space is being filled up. Like slowly people are understanding how to learn from each other and do really amazing things. And some learning from film too, by the way. We really wanted, we were basically, or Sue was approached and asked, like, hey, can you do a book on editorial design? And I think they were expecting, like, another book about, like, magazines or whatever. Some of that is in there.
Right.
But what we wanted to do was, and then Sue said, like, well, it only makes sense that a designer and a editor would pair up, you know, to do this book, because we also wanted to talk about that relationship.
Yeah,
but it also, like, I'm an educator. I teach at Parsons, and year upon year, you just have this whole idea that the web is a separate place from graphic design. And I would be asked year after year, should I be a web designer or a print designer? And I just it was a really absurd question 10 years ago. It just still is an absurd question. And but the only way that I think it can be bridged is to actually present a bigger idea than either web design or print design that binds all of this stuff together.
There's transitional figures, I think, like Jason Santamaria, a friend who obviously is, you know, he approached the web as a web designer, but he had this very rich graphic design experience. And there are plenty of other web designers like that now.
Oh, yeah.
But there weren't.
Yeah, well, because, and actually, Tom Bodkin, who we interviewed, was really eloquent about laying this out. He was just talking about how early on you would have people, because also the web was so much more restrictive about what you could and couldn't do, you would have people just without the practice that you need, you know, to be thinking about, like, type and image and to be a great visual designer, like an editorial designer, that the tools for the practice just weren't there for the longest time.
They were, I would argue, if you were willing to accept the medium for what it was at the time, which a lot of designers weren't. there was sort of this disdain. And then when Flash came out, of course, some of those designers were like, well, now I can control.
Yeah.
But that wasn't really the answer either. It was like, you know, and
it's wanting control over the finished form and, you know, sort of you have to be okay with letting go of some of that control.
Letting go of all of it in a way.
Yeah.
like saying, all right, I have this baseline experience that'll work for anyone, even if they're on a 10-year-old, and you talk about like smartphones and feature phones, right? If they're on a 10-year-old feature phone, mm-hmm. something's got to work too. So I've got to use HTML, and maybe if I'm lucky, you know, the headlines will be bold. And that's all I'm going to have there. And that's okay. And work all the way out to this gorgeous experience when that's, you know, when that's available. How did you, so what are the ideas that you talked about early in the book was that reading hasn't changed. So this thing that everyone was missing, readers are readers and they want to read and designers should design for reading. That was sort of somehow a new idea in web design, like 4 or 5 years ago that became, oh my God. And there was like Dean Allen and Mandy Brown. There were a bunch of people talking about that and realizing it more and more and evangelizing it. And that was a really good thing. But reading hasn't changed and what works for reading hasn't changed, but habits have completely changed. That's your openings. Could you talk more about that idea? That there's the one thing that hasn't changed in 1,000 years, but this other thing, the hunting, the gathering of content, is completely different.
Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I actually, you know, the reading part, it was a different project that I worked on that really hammered that one home. So I worked with David Small on some screens at the Met for the now is what's called the Alti Khalsa wing, was the Islamic wing. And I noticed that we were actually doing the people we were working with were asking us to like give options and like things to jump to and all this kind of stuff. And he was really adamant saying like, no, you just need to be able to know that you're supposed to go from screen to screen. You know, the baseline experience just had to be there in a way that was not ambiguous about what it was you're supposed to do next. And, you know, we worked on this project for, we actually had to do it very quickly, but it was like a really intense project of understanding how much things had not changed on the receiving end. And then that, though, is a fixed experience. You know, you're standing in a museum and you're confronted by just this one device. The other side of the habits part is just like examining ourselves. I mean, the way that I read now, I read 10 times as much. And there's actually this interesting thing that came out recently, too, that millennials, in fact, read more books than mm-hmm. anybody else does. That whole, now I've really started to enjoy that experience of looking for things, hunting them down, hunting and gathering, as you put it, mm-hmm. of saving them, of you know, having a relationship with like different streams and, you know, dumping some and gathering others. And this is what we do now.
I'm not sure how much I read and how much I collect, categorize, share, come up with, oh, I can use this to send it from readability to pocket. Like all these, like basically hack and play with the stuff as much as I actually experience it.
Yeah, I just signed up for reading today and I'm trying to figure out, so how do I integrate
reading?
This?
Reading.
Oh,
hello.
Oh boy. Well, so I guess John Mitchell tweeted about it today and I'd seen a few people tweet about it, Nicole Fenton being one of them. I think it's a way to bookmark, save things that you're reading and share it in a social way so other people that you're friends with know what you're interested in. And I wish I could say a lot more about it, but I've literally only been signed up for about 2 hours. But
Goodreads, Readability, and Pocket all do similar.
Yeah, and
things
I use.
Like
I'm a loyal Instapaper.
Yeah,
you know,
an Instapaper.
I use it like crazy. So I'm trying to figure out. So what's this other way? I mean, I like sharing things that I'm reading. I like seeing what people I like are reading, and so I think it. Yeah, I don't have enough friends on Goodreads, I think, for that to be really useful.
Yeah.
Instapaper and Readability,
Except
I don't
share. It dumps it to Facebook, where someone will see it. So you might have friends on Facebook that see it. Yeah. It doesn't really, you don't have friends on Facebook. You're too much of a hipster for Facebook. Okay. Sorry.
Now that
you guys, as authors, you have to use Facebook.
No.
You can't. Okay.
Well, that's a whole other.
But you, all these channels that you can sort of, it's like before you're public, before you're an author, you're like a private figure and you can use the channels that you like. But once you're a little bit of a public figure, you've got a book, people want to read it. If they're going to be on the Hitler channel, then you have to like figure out how do I address the Hitler channel? Because I've got to have a Hitler strategy too.
I won't be invited to speak on the Hitler channel.
Okay, but Facebook, you know, Facebook.
Okay. Okay. I get it. Now.
You can't just go, I don't use Facebook. I know some really great authors who say I won't use Facebook. And I'm just like, okay. And I totally respect you. But my feeling is, there are readers there who want to get your stuff, then shouldn't you? Yeah.
But also, I mean, a book is a very interesting thing nowadays.
Yeah.
And it is like, we didn't, and Tim O'Reilly had actually said this at a conference that I had gone to, saying like, oh, we wrote this book way back when, but we didn't, the idea for the book was to promote the ideas within the book. Like, we didn't write the book to promote the book. And so,
no, absolutely not.
In a lot of ways, like what we've set out to do ever since we started working on this project is like keeping on coming back to that, saying like that, you know, here are some ideas that we're very passionate about. A book is one way to get to that. Talking about, you know, bringing some, like we're actually having an event next week where we'll have some of the people we interviewed to come and speak about like what they're doing.
Yes.
I'll
be sorry to miss that.
Once you're committed to a kind of idea, you're going to basically promote it whichever way you can. And that comes all the way back to like this whole idea of what is editorial design to begin with, of how do we transmit ideas between humans, and why does that matter? And it matters a lot. And this matters, I mean, we don't talk about this in the book, but you know, just in terms of who controls those transmissions, who controls those experiences, that will determine a lot what ideas will be transmitted in the next few years or not.
Which was the power of the internet, the exciting power of the internet at the beginning was the man isn't controlling the message anymore.
Right.
We're in control of the message.
Now you're making me nostalgic.
But you do see that. You keep seeing that, like the Arab Spring on Twitter. You just keep seeing different examples where someone's voice or someone posts something on Medium that suddenly makes everyone aware that there's this topic that's painful and people have been burying it and not dealing with it. And someone's post on their website or on Medium or somewhere, suddenly it catches fire. That's powerful.
It is.
But on the flip side, there's still this thing, the book, and you have to make the book. I know I'd been evangelizing web standards for 10 years before I wrote Designing with Web Standards, and I actually argued with my publisher. I said, I don't need to write this. I have nothing else to say. I've already said it. Everything's been done. But in fact, the book was much more powerful than all those articles on the web. There's something about, and when I would go promote, I would go speak anywhere and promote the book. It wasn't to sell copies. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but you're not going to get rich from your book. That's not why you do it. You don't write a book like this. Yeah. But you don't want it to be the exception. You don't want it to be that the New York Times or somebody gets it, but most publications don't. You don't want there to constantly be meetings where the designers feel stranded or the art director doesn't talk to the writer. It's like the 50s really before the creative revolution, right, where all these silos that make all this crap.
Right. And in our experience working together, I mean, it was so not siloed. It wasn't like editorial comes up with the whole plan, hands it off to design, you make it pretty, we publish. It was, I mean, the way I experienced being an editor was, you know, working really closely alongside a creative director who was a partner in the process and working together on coming up with the right pairings of writers and photographers and illustrators and the plan for the issue and the layout and what gets prioritized, what's a feature, what's, you know,
constantly talking about like what is it, like what is it that we're making, and that's a really great thing to discuss.
Mm.
Yeah. And I mean, publications are iterative, and there's a lot that, you know, and you wrote, Juliet wrote this, and Trisha, sort of, there's something amazing about the fact that, you know, every time you get this new publication, you know what it is, even though the content is completely different from the last time.
Yeah, that was another.
We saw it.
We were talking about identity.
Yeah.
And how, and it's partly the type and the layout. It's the type of editorial, right? That every time this particular magazine comes out, there's not one word in it that's the same from last time, and yet it's always the New Yorker, or it's always whatever, you know, it's always Vogue, whatever it is. It's always what it is.
But it's, and people who work in software are always iterating. People who are working on the web are always iterating. It's like, this is a very similar pattern. You're looking at what are the ways that we can improve this over time and keep it interesting, keep it adaptive to what we want to tell our readers or what our readers expect. And
even if you're not in publishing, people who work in-house have that advantage of constantly iterating. When you're a hired gun, when you're a consultant or a designer, you know, a graphic designer, you come in, you make a change, you walk away, and then in your mind, and then the client screws it up. But really, what the client's trying to do is evolve it, keep it the same but changing, iterate.
So,
one of the things when we were talking about hypertext, I think Juliet, you were talking about the person you were working with saying, no, don't put all those links in. The original web was so excited about hypertext. It was like, let's everything simultaneously available. I can click all these links in the story and it doesn't matter where I go next. That's up to me, man. That's my freedom. And then it became like, and then it went from that to more of an ebook experience where here I am and here's where I want to go next. Or as web design became more sophisticated, more UX, you know, people start calling themselves UX people. It became like, what do we want them to do? What's our business goal? What's the user's goal? Instead of, let's give them a million things to click on and then they'll be happy.
Yeah.
Japanese web design is still that way. If you go and look at a lot of Japanese websites, it's like Pachinko Palace.
Confusing.
I want to hear about all the people that you wrote this for, because I don't think we've talked about that yet.
So, I mean, it's interesting too to see who we wrote it for and also who has responded the most and the best. One of the things that has made us the most happy is that people who are writers and editors, especially in large organizations, like have given us like so much love, like over the internet, talking. Just being happy that somebody has laid out this connection too between editorial and between design across web and print in a way that makes sense. Because I think a lot of writers and editors right now too, they're being told like, oh, you got to get with it with the internet, or like you're gone or whatever.
Right.
Like there's a lot of like doomsaying without like a lot of explanation at all about like exactly what has changed or like what's going on. And then, you know, like we were kind of asked to write it for designers in a way, if you look at like the publisher and for students too. And like, so partially it is for students of design, but the people who we also wanted to reach were people working for web who also were tired of making websites for Verizon or whatever, like who actually wanted to like think about something they were more passionate about. And then writers and editors who just wanted to know more about what was going on, what was the whole form making that was happening around them, and how could they be, why were they a part of that, and how they could be a part of that.
Is the publisher that you went with, do they reach business audiences and design audiences and tech audiences, or how is that working? I know that could be a tricky question, but
I think their intent is only to reach a sort of young design and design student audience. But honestly, like the I guess this being modern publishing too, like we had so little communication with the publisher beyond just deadlines, and like we just never really got to talk to them at depth about like who
where
they wanted
would go.
To. Like they would just say like, well, you know, just do it, and like we'll just take it from there. Like they didn't really seem to have a clear plan about how they wanted to also what their strategy was.
It was up to you to strategize and market and design and everything else.
Yeah.
But I mean, this collaboration... Sorry.
Oh, yeah, no, so we made the book that we wanted to make.
Absolutely.
Where the audiences that we recognize could use it most. You know, the print designers who were unsure about how to take their skills onto the web or app design, for the web designers who weren't familiar with editorial, and for the students who
weren't familiar with anything.
Yeah, and so we kind of defined that and trusted that the publisher knew how to market it to a design or to universities and such. So we're still not sure. We're still waiting for our first statement of royalty of sales. We don't know how it's
that can take 6 months or more.
Yeah.
Just so. But it looks like you weren't interfered with. It's a gorgeous design.
Thank you. And the
structure is wonderful. And the writing is funny and has a voice, and it doesn't feel like anyone worried about it or dumbed it down or made you constantly define everything. It seemed like you trusted that the reader was intelligent and nobody made you change that. It seems like they might not have been a hand-holdy publisher, but they weren't an interfering publisher.
That's correct.
Oh, yes. they were more concerned with word count rather than the words themselves.
I would say
that anecdote. Oh. But I think, you know,
Let's hear that story.
No.
Well, the first the first manuscript we submitted was 60,000 words, and they just sent it back to us saying, like, we said 40,000.
and then
I laid it all out and said it fits in the print dimensions that we need, and then we printed it with 60,000 words.
Well, no, actually, so I wanted to be diplomatic and say, okay, maybe it is too long. We went back and we read through it. We cut some stuff, and then we added more.
Yeah,
and
that always happens.
63,000 words.
Right. So,
and that is not too long of a book at all. No. I don't think it feels too wordy.
No,
so.
It doesn't. I have on my desk, I have the new, like, Photoshop Bible, which that's a big book. That's a thing, like, I want to take it in the bathtub, but I really can't.
No, because that's where you want to be working on Photoshop.
No, but that's where, like, you know, if it's sort of like you can browse through and go, oh, how do you do that? Or here's, you know, yeah. I've always ignored that set of toolbars. What are they about? But you can't. It's too heavy. Great book, but too heavy. This, like, you can read in,
good.
You could take this to the beach, you know.
Yeah.
It's not too big.
We had also interviewed all these wonderful people, and you know, we were just not. They said a lot of really wonderful things, and we just were not willing to cut each one down to like a nominal blurb. It was worth saving, and we didn't want to cut anybody out either.
How did you pick the case studies and the interviewees?
Oh, that was probably the hardest part of the process. Like, we wanted a range of different types of publications, like different scales, also different countries, though that was really hard. So many of the people are still from New York. We just tried to make it so that we didn't have a constant, that it wasn't this repetitive thing, you know, of like people saying the same thing over and over again, but rather... that we had a variety of perspectives to be able to bring in there. Because we have some case studies where the designer's not even willing to touch the internet. You know, they're just like they're not into it. And like, but asking them about that, asking them like, well, what is the nature of the print object now that we live in this environment? Like, they still had a very strong perspective on that. It wasn't like they were living under a rock. They just had like a specific strategy for themselves that they were taking on.
And I think also like one of the ways we thought about structuring the book to begin with was around time and frequency, because you know that how frequently you publish having an impact on how you design and how you present information. So it's loosely structured that way. You know, we start with BuzzFeed and we finish with the Wax magazine. And it somewhat has that, but then we ended up sort of moving things around based on what people said, what people told us. Some of the things that came up in one interview really tied in well with something else. And so we moved it around for
nice
that.
Nice to interview people from the same publication, but on different like who have different roles, and hearing like how we have Steve Motzenbecker from New York Magazine, who tells a very different story from
right.
Stella Bugbee. You know, like it was nice to hear that difference. We didn't want to have every single person be designer, creative director, et cetera, that we actually, yeah. And then we also wanted to put people in who we just thought were good thinkers about the space mm-hmm. That we were talking about. Like, you know, I mean, we had actually, I wish we could have printed the entire Paul Ford interview, which yeah. would have taken up like probably 20 pages.
But I wish I could just publish all of Paul Ford.
Right.
You and me both.
And it's funny. He thinks he's making no sense, and it's totally brilliant.
Yeah.
It's like he thinks he's blathering on, and I'm like, no, keep going.
And then we wanted to talk to people like David Jacobs and David Slate about their own, like, because the other interesting thing that we found out as we were doing this was we would try to kind of associate people with publications or whatever, but a lot of people move around from yeah. thing to thing very quickly
yeah.
and they learn a lot in doing that. And so they were very insightful about their experiences across different scenarios and publications.
Yeah. Not to cut you off, but I think people who work in this area in publishing and whatever medium, they are very passionate. I mean, the reason they put up with really difficult, you know, difficult demands on their time and everything. People who do it for a passion for publishing. And so, yeah, David Jacobs at 29th Street Publishing, he started in blog platforms, and now he's like really dedicated to finding a way for independent publishers and authors to try to sell subscriptions to their content. And you know, he wouldn't be doing that. There's probably ways that he could get richer faster, you know, but this is what he's committed to doing. So a lot of the people in the book, I think, are people who do this because they feel really strongly about the work they do.
Yeah. You kind of have to.
Yeah.
It's like going into acting or music or something.
Right. Yeah.
It kind of is. I mean, it's a little more regular than that. There's a little bit better benefits, but not a lot different. What is next for the book and the book tour? What are you doing? Where are you next week? What are you doing next week?
We're here in New York. We just got a space at the New School to do a small panel discussion, and we'll have Renda Morton and David Jacobs, David Slate, Justin Thomas Kay,
Jeanetta Bink,
and
Chris Johannesson from BuzzFeed.
Yeah, talking.
Sounds fantastic.
And it's great because like they'll be like, "Hi, how are you?" And like that makes me very happy because you know like they're not all from the same world. And
yeah, I mean, also for all these people to meet each other, I think is kind of great. I'm looking forward to leaving time for people to talk to each other
and connect.
This. Yeah.
Will there be snacks?
Of course.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, from there.
Where is that? What time?
So that's going to be on Tuesday evening at 7:30 at 55 West 13th.
Seven o'clock.
At 55 West 13th Street.
Yeah.
That sounds like a fun time. If you're in this area, and you have a website for designing the editorial experience, that's editorialexperience.com.
Yes.
That is.
And we are also currently working on putting together a blog on the site that will track and talk about and critique what's going on, especially in the web space for editorial experiences online, which is not really it's talked about here and there in various other platforms, but no one's really dedicated to that specific topic.
That sounds good. And you had Jeremy Zillar
yes.
design your website.
Yes.
And it's very beautiful.
So
this is really good. I think we're running out of time, but Juliet and Sue, I want to thank you both very much. The book is Designing the Editorial Experience, a primer for print, web, and mobile. You know what? We'll stop saying those words soon, I think. Don't you? It'll just be
yes.
The editorial experience.
Everywhere. Yes.
Yes. But for right now, a primer for print, web, and mobile to make sure that the customer knows, you know, I work in mobile. I'm not, oh, okay, you got me. Good enough. It's a really wonderful, gorgeous, beautifully written book with a lot of ideas that matter to art directors, designers, writers, content strategists, UXers, you name it. So thank you both. Good luck next week and talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.